You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Margaret Weiss. Margaret, it's good to have you here this morning.
Good to be here.
Good. So the way the show begins is with a huge question, and you can take it however you want, but who are you? What do we need to know about the qualities you aspire to, maybe, or the labels you wear, or your history, that to start the conversation, because we're modeling how we get to know each other.
So I think I have a lot of identities that I carry with me. I'm the youngest child of public school teachers, which I lift up because I think, especially right now, there's a lot of conversation about education, and I have a lot of thoughts and feelings about that, given that my whole family's teachers, and I'm sort of the anomaly in that.
But not by much.
Not by much. I am a minister, which is really central to my identity, and I think for me, it's very difficult for me to sort of, at this point, piece apart who I am as an individual versus who I am as a minister.
Sure.
For me, in order to be a good minister, I need to be most authentically myself and
fully present and accounted for.
Absolutely. Amen. So, yeah, I'm a wife, I'm a sister, I'm an auntie. I have dogs. I'm an athlete, musician. I don't know. I feel like I'm making myself sound a lot more interesting than I actually am.
But when I ask this question, people oftentimes don't realize how many labels they wear.
Yeah.
Or whatever. So authenticity is a quality you aspire to, but also what other relational or value qualities do you identify with?
I think just love in general, humor, the ability to not take myself so seriously. And oftentimes I'll say, you know, I wish that person would take themselves so seriously. And then I think, I should probably do the same thing. Right. So I think being realistic about the fact that I'm human and that I will make mistakes and that I will do some things well and I will do some things not so well, and that's okay. And I'm really grateful to be at that place. I haven't always been at that place where I've felt that way. But I think, you know, in a series of events and experiences that has sort of come out to be the reality that I don't really have all that much energy to not be authentic in how I'm feeling in the moment.
Right. And if you're going to be that way, you had better have a lot of love and a lot of humor. You're the first, I think a few people have introduced themselves with this quality of clarity, of realism, but I don't think anybody ever did with love and humor right next to each other. So good.
You're welcome.
Thank you. So what music should we open the show with? You know, you brought some music with you. What would be a good way to start this show?
I think The Sun Will Rise. Kelly Clarkson.
Okay.
Song.
So here we go. And do you want to say anything about it or just play it?
I think for me, this song, I've gotten a lot of strength in realizing that I don't have to do everything all at once, that there's each day has certain opportunities in it, and I'm not going to accomplish everything I want to in one day. And that oftentimes, at the end of the day, I may be sort of disappointed that things didn't work out the way I wanted them to in a certain situation, but that the sun will rise the next day. There is new opportunity. So
here we go.
I can see the weight there in your eyes. I can feel the thorn in your side. Your knuckles are bruised from a losing fight. One way down a dead end street, broken glass underneath your feet. You think the day won't break the sunless night. The sun will rise. The sun will rise. Couldn't move, couldn't breathe, couldn't find a way.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Margaret Weiss. So, Margaret, given the life that you live now mm-hmm. and that you value now, what experiences have you had to have to know that this is what you want to be doing now?
Great question. So I think for me, I'm assuming you mean ministry, being a minister.
Well, my questions are so, they're so big that some people find them overwhelmingly problematic, mm-hmm. but they're big enough. You can take them wherever you want to take them.
Okay.
And I will ask a more personal version if you want to go professional but given that that's who you are.
Right.
That's
Okay. Well, so I think, I'll do both. So I think for me, two big things happened when I was in eighth grade. So I was 13 years sure. old. First, my sister, who was 4 years older than me, was pregnant and ended up giving birth to my niece, who's now 20. She'll be 21 next month. And I grew up in a affluent, upper middle class suburb of Boston, mostly white. It was a town where that didn't happen, where teenage girls did not have completed pregnancies. So I think what I learned in that experience was a lot about people. I learned that people can be really cruel to one another. That, I had friends whose parents wouldn't let me play at their house because they felt like my family had bad values. But I also learned about the human capacity for love, that many more people really rallied around my sister and my family. So she was able to complete high school on time and complete community college mm-hmm. and then ultimately a 4-year degree. And she's an amazing teacher. I think the reason why I bring that up is because it was probably one of the first times that I realized that the things we say and the way that we behave are not always in line. The things we say, we sure. believe, right? Sure. And that people can be very kind to one another sort of on the surface, but when things get hard, they don't always stick around. Mm-hmm. So I guess the way that that plays in for me now as an adult is trying to help people to have those two things match one another, have myself make those two ideas match one another. So
kindness and loyalty.
Yeah. Well, I guess that being in community with one mm-hmm, another mm-hmm. doesn't always mean things are going to be easy.
Right.
It actually usually doesn't mean things are going to be easy in my experience.
Communities are, from my definition of a community is where the fight is worth having.
Yeah. Right.
And so take it in all of its love and its pain.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, and I think that, in that particular instance, judgment isn't actually super helpful in that instance.
No, it doesn't help you.
So whether you have an opinion or not about, my niece being born doesn't change the fact that she's being born and that we have two directions to go in and with
that. The
time
for opinions was 10 years ago or 10 years from now.
right. Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's one formative sort of experience mm-hmm. for me from my childhood. The other thing that happened that year was I had two classmates of mine who were in the year below me complete suicide. And within a few weeks of one mm-hmm. another. So I was 13 and dealing with, this whole thing in my family. But then having that happen, I think that was, again, another realization that that the way that we treat one another matters. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was really a realization for myself that emotional intelligence is really important to me and being in tune with how other people are feeling and how things impact other people mm-hmm. and me was really important to me. I think, it's interesting in the whole formation process of ministry, mm-hmm. We do mm-hmm. so much reflection sure. on who we are and why and what's formed us.
Right.
And I think for that story, for me, I've talked with friends of mine who I grew up with, who I've mentioned, when Jeff and Kat died, that was really formative for me. And they're like, you didn't even really know them. And I'm like, right, I know. This is what right. is sort of amazing. And for them, it wasn't a formative experience, but for me it was. And I think it continues. I mean, that was 20 years ago, mm-hmm, and it continues mm-hmm. to shape who I am.
Right.
And my hope that we can get to a place where people can be honest about what's really hard in their lives right. and find community around it.
Right, right. And I mean, and it also shows that you had an assumption that the life of someone you don't even know well is as important as your own life.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And that kind of radical sense of equality or equity is,
right.
I think that forces us to think what connections could be, should be, might be different if we were to really be common, community,
right.
equal.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the concept I find behind what you're talking about, I talked about, you were talking about kindness and community, and I threw in there loyalty, and the word that ties them together is covenant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Where we do for each other what we cannot do for ourselves but need in order to thrive.
Right, absolutely.
And we don't do for each other what we can do because that just gets in all sorts of boundary ways.
Right, yep, yep.
And that's just that's a neat place to start life. To start your conscious life
right.
at 13.
Absolutely.
Yeah. My first nephew was born when I was 13, but my sister was 30 at the time.
Okay.
So a big difference because of the age difference in the
yep.
family. But I have four sisters, and every 6 months another sister had another
mm-hmm.
baby.
Mm-hmm.
And so I grew up as this guy around changing diapers and playing with kids and doing all of this stuff that
right.
most guys would have done 100 years ago in rural areas, but they didn't do necessarily then.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was kind of neat.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think for me, having my niece, she was actually born, she was due on my birthday, but she was born the day after.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's 13 years younger than me. And now it's just amazing for me to have seen her sort of blossom into this amazing young woman. And really, I think what's great about it is that I have this unique relationship with her that, yes, I'm her aunt, and so mm-hmm, I'm a mm-hmm. source of authority in her life. At least I think I am. I don't know if she thinks I am.
well, yeah.
But, and so I'm a trusted person that she can come to and talk to about hard things that maybe she wouldn't talk to her parents mm-hmm. about, but although she's very close with them too. But I also get to be sort of a friend mm-hmm. to her.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I'm very grateful for her and for my family and the way that they mm-hmm. sort of rallied at that time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the Greek word for authority is exousia,
mm-hmm.
what oozes out of being, what comes out of being,
mm-hmm.
What is from being. And so as an authority, we can really only author what we are, what
mm-hmm.
we know, and we can draw that out of others, which is education. Educare to lead it out of others.
Right, right.
And that's so it doesn't necessarily have the heavy hand of command control, which is what we've associated authority
right.
with, but it has a lot to do with emotional intelligence.
Right, right.
And drawing each other out.
Yeah.
Where should we go musically?
Let's do Hands by Jewel.
Okay. Here we go.
If I could tell the world just one thing, it would be that we're all okay. And not to worry, 'cause worry is wasteful and useless in times like these. Idled with despair, I'll gather myself around my faith, the light the darkness most fear. My hand, the small I know, but they're not yours, they are my own. But they're not yours, they are my own, and I am never broken. Stole your golden shoes, it didn't steal your laughter. And heartache came to visit me, but I knew it wasn't ever after. We will fight, not out of spite, 'cause someone must stand up for what's right. 'Cause where there's a man who has no voice, there are shadows singing. They're not yours.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Margaret Weiss. So Margaret, in this place, this community space of community, where we can, you know, share more or less what's going on in our lives with relative trust and safety, how do you get there?
How long do we have?
What are things that showed, you described the incidents which provoked your awareness of the need, the pregnancy with your sister, 4 years older at 17, yep. and the suicide of two friends when you were, at the same time, roughly.
Yep.
What did you learn about communication and relationship that makes this possible?
So I think actually, if I'm being totally honest, coming out of at the time, I don't know that I fully appreciated any of that.
No,
right?
No, you're just struggling.
I think, right. I'm just like, wow, life is hard. Honestly, I mean, if I'm really thinking it through, I think it really wasn't until I did hospital chaplaincy and learned about humility in a way that I think humility is a huge part of it. I think, and the type of humility to be able to say, to enter into a hard conversation, but be able to say, I don't have all the answers, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and I say this all the time as a minister, that I don't have all the answers, and people are like, their minds are blown.
Right.
But I don't expect to have all the answers. I don't think any minister has all the answers.
Can I just...
Yeah,
and ahead. Don't confuse my excitement about the issue with having the answers.
Yeah.
Because that's how I'm often misread as arrogant, because my excitement, because we can figure this out.
Right,
and
right.
That doesn't mean I have in my back pocket a hidden answer. It means that, we are, come hell or high water, we're going to figure this out.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, I mean, I think a step in it is having the ability to say that we don't have the answers.
We don't have
I think
the answers.
That's the
We're
first question,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Or the first piece of the puzzle. And so for me, I learned that when I was a hospital chaplain, and I would be called to these situations in emergency rooms, it was a trauma hospital. Mm-hmm. And I sort of had this idea that that I could somehow make the situation better, that was my job, was to make the situation better.
Right.
I quickly learned that that was not my job, that my job was to just be and to help people make it through, whatever that meant.
To just be, which means be with the situation, mm-hmm. which means you're not inactive, but you're with the situation. You're not ahead of it or behind it.
Right.
And to help people get through it, but not just to survive it, because if they get through it as human beings, they will have learned, done, been mm-hmm. something other than who they assumed they were.
Right.
In the beginning.
Yeah. And I think the way that those experiences that I had when I was younger mm-hmm. and the hospital chaplaincy are tied together is that, and how it ties back to the piece about loyalty mm-hmm. that you were talking about before, is, again, being in community with people, being present to their pain, to their struggle, to their wondering about what, mm-hmm. Why is all of this happening? It's a willingness to stay tuned in and a willingness to stay part of the conversation.
Right. And before humility gets traction, mm-hmm. I have to accept that is the one. The other person is the one dying. The other person is the mm-hmm. one suffering. The other person is the others are whatever. And then recognize that I may too in this, but my role is to be aware of them.
Right. Right.
And then to take care of myself. Definitely, but secondarily.
Right.
Not in secondary in importance, but secondary in order.
Right.
And then as the humility kicks in terms of just, humility is an absence of assumptions
mm-hmm.
in a profound sense. And it's just open to what is.
Right.
So you see, for me, there are two things that had to change. And one of them was my sense of timing. Had to mm-hmm. slow down because I tend to be a real fast processor and I tend to be all over stuff.
Yep.
And that's not helpful. but in a really intense crisis where things are moving 1,000 miles for everybody else, they're moving kind of slow for me.
Mm-hmm.
So that really is helpful.
Yep.
And also learning to, well, I don't know how to ask this as a question. I should, as a chaplain, but that, when you're, okay, so when your life slows down, mm-hmm. so you can express and be and exercise that humility in relationships that are moving forward, how do you change? How did you have to change as a human being?
I think I had to change from feeling, I had to change my intention going into the space that that was actually part of my role, was to help slow things down a little bit,
mm-hmm.
Which is not how I naturally am,
mm-hmm.
either. I'm a planner. I like to know what's going to happen. I like to know what to do when this happens. And, but I think there was trust in that. There was trusting that, that the doctors and the nurses were doing what they mm-hmm. had been trained to do.
Mm-hmm.
And
you have to embody that trust so you don't undermine or triangulate them when the family or the patient may be at odds
right.
with them.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And I think I also had to, in some ways, learn to be, just to give people permission to feel how they felt.
Mm-hmm.
And not even, I mean, I don't mean like verbally giving them permission, but right. just holding that space so that people could...
When you're non-reactive, when you're not defensive or pushing, they fill the void.
Right, right. So I think those are the main things. But also, you know, so it's interesting because my experience as a hospital chaplain, as a UU, as a Unitarian Universalist, mm-hmm. I was so afraid that people were going to ask me to pray.
Mm-hmm.
Like... And sure enough, the first day someone did.
and
it's like I had a blinking sign over my head. And I had this little book, you know, I had this little black book that had all these prayers mm-hmm. that were written in it. And I had looked up prayers from all different religions yep. and traditions.
You
and
were a good
for
student.
For this situation and that situation. And I never opened it.
Mm-hmm.
and I began to realize that there's not a prayer actually in a book that you can read to a woman who is grieving the loss of her fourth child to yep. gun violence. Like, there's not a prayer for that that's written down already.
Right. So what did you do?
So I tapped into what she had told me.
Was important.
I tried to speak to the pain, which... Mm-hmm.
What is the scream I need to lift right now
exactly.
on your behalf?
Right.
Yeah.
I don't even know. I don't know that I could write down what I said in that moment, but I think I realized that it was actually the first time I'd ever prayed, really, mm-hmm. in those situations. I'm not a prayer.
Right, right.
But for me, it came out of what I had just heard and mm-hmm. witnessed and felt in me that I wanted to sort of put out into the universe.
Whether it's the sorrow of a depth you cannot imagine, or the case against God for a damned mm-hmm. situation, or whether it's the words you long to hear that you can tell the other person, but yeah. you can't speak them to yourself.
Right, right. Yeah, and so I think that, you know, And it's funny because as a UU minister,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I preached about prayer a couple weeks ago, which was really interesting.
You yeah. know,
I can just feel people tense up. but I think for me, my prayers were also like bringing cold water to people who were waiting in
we're
the emergency
thirsty.
Room, waiting
yeah,
to
yeah,
hear
yeah.
about their loved
yeah,
one,
yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah,
or like
yeah.
coloring with a child whose father had just had a heart attack and who I was trying to like... entertain so that the doctors could do what they could do mm. and his mom could be with his dad. Like, and I think, you know, I do it as a minister in this sort of amplified way,
mm-hmm.
As a chaplain in this sort of way that people say, oh, that's so brave. But people do that all the time, right? I mean, that's how we show up for each other. We, we do hard stuff for each other because we love each other and we belong to one another.
We do hard stuff for each other when we notice each other.
Right.
Because there are lots of people sitting in the rooms that are not noticed. Mm-hmm. We do hard stuff when we have a relationship of curiosity with each other.
Right.
We do hard stuff when we have a commitment, a shared commitment of any sort.
Yeah.
This is really, I am a chaplain without, I'm actually part of the on-call team at Cayuga Medical Center.
Okay.
And another hat that I wear, but this approach to meeting people where they are. Mm-hmm. So for me, I had to learn that I can pray like a Pentecostal,
mm-hmm.
in Spanish. Or with an African American, you know, elderly women who were 30, 40 years old, 50 years older than I was at the time. And they would find it meaningful, not because I was any good at it, because I cared,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you get better at it when you practice.
Right. And it's not, and I think, you know, I'm sure that there were prayers that I said that were horrible in terms of like structure and grammar and things like that. But I don't think that matters.
Right. And even the word choice wasn't the best, but boy, right. We knew what she meant.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So how do you bring, the $64 question in my work, mm-hmm. is how do you create space where people who are not in crisis,
mm-hmm.
can begin to experience the fear and, I mean, it's terror,
mm-hmm.
and the awe of having that access to each other's lives, because we don't routinely have that kind of access to each other's lives because we have these privacy assumptions.
Right.
Rather than, we've confused privacy and self-determination. We've opted for privacy when what we really mm-hmm. want is a more say about ourselves without total control. But we've opted for privacy, which means nobody can help us.
Yeah.
And we're not any good to ourselves at a certain point. But when your congregation tensed up as you were preaching on prayer,
mm-hmm.
or speaking, I don't know if you preach in your tradition.
Well, I preach.
But when you were speaking on preaching on prayer, what was that tension about and how do you address it?
So for me, I think, and I'm a lifelong Unitarian Universalist, mm-hmm. so I was raised in this tradition.
So you're a cradle Unitarian.
I am. So. I mean, technically I was like 2.5, well, but you know, whatever details.
Okay.
My mother was Catholic. My father was Congregationalist, and they basically
that was the standard compromise.
Yep. So back they in that day they were, you know, an interfaith couple. But they basically found the UU Church, and I was raised there.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, I sort of have been raised in this tradition of not anti-religion, but anti-dogma.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I actually just preached about this yesterday, about, you know, this idea that we have about religion. And I have people in my pews who say, you know, I don't agree with organized religion. I'm like, it's just funny because you're here, like you're in a pew sitting here listening to my sermon.
Your behavior belies you.
Right. But I think what I try to help people in my congregation see is that it doesn't have to be one way or the other, that things can be somewhere in between. I think, you know, I talk about prayer,
mm-hmm.
and I was specifically talking about what a colleague of mine, Barbara Tenhove, refers to as wounded words that we have,
mm-hmm.
words
mm-hmm.
like prayer and God and church and
words that we almost have to bring them out of their damaged state.
Right. And we have to reclaim them. Yeah. We have to reclaim this idea that someone else gets to determine what prayer is, and that if I don't believe what that is, that then I don't get to pray. Like, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that's the subjective use of words as opposed to some assumed objective use.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, what I think is unfortunate, and what I've learned in my process has been that when we're resistant to words like that or ideas like mm-hmm, that,
sure.
We miss out. Because we're letting someone else define something for us. And so, you know, when I started seminary, I went to a Christian seminary. I was UU. I'd never had a Bible before. I actually bought a children's Bible. That's how I learned many of the stories. The only stories I knew, the only story really that I knew was Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat.
And you learned it by other means.
Right, exactly. And
you got accepted at a seminary that I got turned down from.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I was living with an atheist, like a... and not, we were not married. This was 1982, 83.
Yep.
And that was just not going to fly.
Interesting. Well, I mean, so that seminary now is like, I think
things change.
It's like the second biggest, you know, group is UU. So many of them are atheists, but so, which is interesting, right? That there's a bunch of atheists at a seminary. That I think we could have a whole other radio show on that.
Well, and Union Seminary at the time, I had no congregational membership, no denominational sponsorship. And they said, we've seen your kind before. We're not afraid of you. Mm. They literally said that.
Yeah.
You know, so come.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, and they've continued to get even, they have Muslims and Jews and Hindus Buddhists who teach an affiliation with the seminary because we have to do that.
Right. Days. Right. Yeah. And that's the thing is that I think.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I mean, I think, you know, you asked how do I, when I felt people tense up about prayer, right? How do I help them stay in the conversation. And I think for me, so often it's through story. Mm-hmm. Sometimes my own story about how I've wrestled with something and come out on the other side.
Right.
And sometimes it's a story of, you know, from that I've heard or that's from a friend of mine or that is even from popular culture, you know, movies and books. And because I think stories are what helps us make sense of the world and find ourselves in these bigger issues that can feel really abstract.
Right. And if I'm feeling tense and uncomfortable and you tell me a story, even if it's not your own, but you own it.
Yep.
Because you live the truth of it. You experience the truth of it. Because we can borrow from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's any problem with that as long as it's done with profound respect.
Right.
You know, and then that will help me because it's not an intellectual engagement of my emotional reaction.
Right.
It is a story which can help slowly untie the knots that I've got myself reacted into.
Yeah.
If I'm viscerally reacting.
Yeah.
And those are the hardest things for us to get over are our visceral reactions.
Right. Right. I think another piece is that.
Let me do the station ID within the time frame.
Okay, yeah.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Margaret Weiss.
So I think the other piece that's important to lift up is I think we get stuck in our thinking and in our identities and in our worldview. And sometimes we need someone to sort of help us get unstuck. And part of that is about realizing that things aren't either this way or that way. Mm-hmm. So often they're somewhere in between.
Or they are both ways at the same time,
right.
Which is another...
Yeah.
I tend to be an extremist, so I want to go to that.
Right. And I think our society has become so divisive right in this moment.
That we want one side or the other.
That we're either this or we're that. And there's no, you know, there... How are you supposed to get unstuck in that situation? How is anyone supposed to find their way to even seeing the other side or trying to understand the other side? And I think that, you know, folks who are conservative do that. I think folks who are liberal do that. I think folks who are in between do that. I think we're limiting ourselves by thinking that things can't be simultaneously true at the same time, and that there's not some sort of gray area in between.
Yeah.
Like, we're not stupid beings, humans, but sometimes we get into this, like...
Stuckness. I have taken, in the last 6 months or so, I have taken to, without any hesitation, saying, I am white trash.
Hmm.
Now, you watch the liberals try to cover me over with blankets of syrupy acceptance... Or you watch people who've felt the sting of that slam and they want to, they just like, you know, you of all people, you have this Ivy League education multiple times over, you know, but I grew up, I am Scots-Irish, white trash. And that forces a whole lot of shit out on the table.
Right.
But I can only do it because I am no longer ashamed of it.
Mm.
You know, and I'm almost 60 years old, and that's a long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I didn't even know to be ashamed of it until I left the area. Because it was something I took on by my desire to be something other.
Oh,
you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, and there was more of value there than I knew, and less in some way of where I went to.
Right.
So that's been a serious reality. You had a piece of music you wanted to play with us. Shall we go there now?
And yes.
Do you want to introduce it?
So this is Back to the Middle by India Ari. I think it speaks to what we've been talking about the stuckness that we can feel in roles and in opinions and the possibility of finding a different way.
Yeah. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Margaret Weiss. So Margaret, I the way we close out the show, and it's a little bit early, so maybe we'll bounce around with some other, there's kind of torn between two questions. You know, I guess maybe just throw out one of these questions. It may be quick.
Okay.
Nothing's quick, but
I talk a lot, so it may,
well,
we
both talk a lot. So have you had to change in ways that you would not have anticipated or chosen? And that could be just a personal style thing, or it could be a moral value, or it could be a political agenda. Have you, because you're young enough that you may not have run into that, but you're also living kind of full out in a way that you may already have run into that wall.
Right. I mean, I think, yes, just even, so I've been in ministry 5 years, and I guess 5 years, and I think, so I'm the youngest child in my family.
Mm-hmm.
I am a chronic overachiever. I like to do things well, and I don't like to not do things well. I don't think that's unique. I think most people like to do things well.
Well,
right?
By whatever the standard is.
Now, right.
We have kind of really incredibly, you know, if you miss it by 1/64th of an inch, you're off.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I think that I have spent a lot of my life trying to be who I think people want me to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I've learned is that really all I can be is myself. And that doesn't mean that I shouldn't strive to be the best version of myself that I can be. But
you have to own it.
Right. It's an ownership thing.
The locus of control is inside of you and not out there with
them. Right. Right. And so I think, you know, I've changed in that I try not to think of what the right answer is to something, but just sort of be true in the moment and speak whatever my truth is in the mm-hmm. moment, which is not easy, right? Mm-hmm. When you have this job where you're preaching every week and exploring these different issues, and people have lots of opinions about whether those issues are valuable or whether you're expressing them or exploring them in, you know, to the proper depth and all of that. But I feel like I've come to this place, and I hope I continue to be in this place where I just have to believe that I'm enough, and that I sometimes will get it wrong, and that's okay.
Right. Yes, because that's a place to be comfortable with. And if you've been judging yourself by other standards for a long time, you need an oasis.
Yeah.
But there comes a time, I think, and when it's appropriate to feel like, you know, I could have done better. Now, how would I do that differently? And that's not a shame. It's not about shame. It's not even about guilt.
Right.
It's just about a desire, a longing for the flowing streams where you are richer than you were before.
Right. Well, and I think for me, that makes me a better minister. It makes me a better sister, a better wife, a better auntie, a better daughter, that the more that I'm able to say, wow, that didn't go well, you know, how can I make that better? I'm helping the people who I love, whether it's my family or my friends or my community, realize that like they don't have to be perfect either. And I don't expect them to be, you know. So yesterday I preached, about humanism, and I talked about Mr. Rogers, who was a Presbyterian, right? But
he's
a Presbyterian minister.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
But you know, I talked about Mr. Rogers and how he would tell me, I mean, cause he was talking to me
to
obviously.
You directly. It was, yes, you were there.
Right.
He was the only one in the room.
Exactly. He was telling me that he liked me just the way I was. And, you know, and I said that at the end of the service yesterday to my congregation. And there were people who came up to me afterwards and they were like, thank you for saying that to me. And I think, you know, we don't get told that enough.
Yeah. Yeah.
We live in a society that wants us to always be better, to be the best, to be, you know, to take a stand on this particular issue and to know everything about it and to not back down and all of this stuff. And I think strength and resilience are important. And I think we're going to mess up sometimes.
Right, right, right. I'd almost hesitate to say this, but has hesitation ever stopped me?
Do it.
In groups, one of the things that I do is I'm a wrestler. I argue with you. And what happens is oftentimes when I argue, the person feels like they're fighting it out with an ex-spouse, or they're fighting it out. I become somebody else in their drama.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'm just off the wall, and that's, I mean, I'm comfortable with being off the wall some of the time. But the point is that I want them at the end of the argument to know that I love them, not without any sappy sweet over-reflection on it, but that we can stop and we'd be at peace with each other.
Right.
And if you talk about it too much, you kill it.
Right.
You have to really feel it.
Well, and it's not, for me, that love is not like a Hallmark card kind of love. It's like a fierce, you know, belief that you as an individual and me as an individual may or may not have the same opinion on something.
But you're worth it.
But it matters that we each have it, right? Yeah, and and I think that's the individualism that I think is important, is for people to feel a sense of ownership over themselves and over their beliefs and their values, but not in a way that they use that as a weapon.
Right, right. And that's the stewardship. That's the care for. But all in that same sense, we own each other.
Right.
In a relationship of mutual respect, we really own each other.
Yeah.
Because we're taking care of each other.
Right.
And if we don't take each other with that kind of sense of ownership of taking care, we will ignore.
Right.
We will leave other people to die. We will say, oh, you have to figure it out yourself. Right. Or, you know.
Yeah. And we other each other in that situation, right? We say like, oh, you're not, you know, this is the circle of people who matter and you're not in that circle. Right. So I'm going to, you know, tune out from what your concern is.
Thank you for the digression. The question is now, what do you do to take care of yourself intellectually, emotionally, and physically throughout the day, daily, weekly, monthly, yearly? And how do you know you need to do it?
Great question. So what do I do to take care of myself? I've already mentioned I don't take myself too seriously. So
except when you do.
Except when I do. And then when I do, I try not to. I think... So, I mean, there's a few sort of practical things that I do. I am a planner, and so I like to have, I actually have this planner that I usually have with me. I don't have it right now. That, you know, I've put in it sort of not just work stuff that I need to do, but intentionally writing down other things like exercising on a regular basis, drinking enough water. I never drink enough water. Mm-hmm. I'm always dehydrated. Something which is funny because I have this giant water bottle with me. But one of the things I recently learned, which my wife finds hilarious, is that actually one of the biggest causes of dehydration, at least in our country, is if you talk too much, you actually can dehydrate yourself, which I felt like I had an epiphany when I learned that, because I was like, that's it. That's the reason why I drink water all day and I'm still dehydrated, because I talk so much.
It's that expelling the moisture from your lungs.
Yeah, something. Anyway, my wife laughed very hard when I told her that. She's like, this is not surprising to me. So I try to do all those things. I really do love exercising. So that is a huge outlet for me.
And as an athlete, that's...
You know, yeah. And I've, you know, and I haven't done it here, but I used to do Bikram yoga a lot. Mm-hmm. And for me, having that sort of regimented... I don't know. Have you done Bikram yoga?
Yeah.
Having that sort of the same, you know, the same series of things every day, it was very sort of meditative for me. I have started in the last like 6 weeks meditating in the morning and evening, which is a lot for me to sit quietly. I'm not great at being quiet, but I'm learning to be. And so that's helpful for me. I think overall, for me, the way I try to take care of myself is to have a routine, and that really helps me feel balanced and feel like, balanced, I think, is the biggest thing.
Right.
I think, you know, intellectually, I listen to a lot of podcasts. I've been trying to read more, though it's hard to find time to be able to do that. And that's part of why I like listening to the podcast, because I don't have to be sitting reading. I can, you know, listen while I'm in the car or something like that. And emotionally, I think spending time with other people is how I recharge. I'm absolutely an extrovert. And so for me, you know, a lot of people, and I'm included in this, a lot of ministers, Sunday afternoon is really hard. It's like, you know, you sort of hit this adrenaline wall and every Sunday afternoon I get put in for a nap and
you crash.
And I crash. But it's also a really amazing time for me. It really does recharge me to be, you know, having a shared experience with, you know, 175 people with music and with singing and with, you know, reflecting on ideas. Like, it really is a great part of what I do and a great privilege, you know, that people come and sit and listen to what I have to say for, which, as I mentioned to you when we came in, I'm the youngest child, right? So that doesn't happen all the time.
Whole community listening to you.
But it's
I used to turn a pot over on top of, I turned a big stew pot over and I would stand and conduct the orchestra.
Oh, really? Well, what's funny is that I actually, when I was a kid, so my parents are teachers, right? Mm-hmm. So we would play school all the time, which I'm sure they loved that they came home from school and I was like, let's play school and more. But I would line up my stuffed animals and I would just talk at them. And I guess I was preaching. I don't know. I don't think that's what I thought I was doing. I was just talking.
You were expressing yourself.
I was expressing myself. But yeah, so I think, you know, for me, that is a huge privilege that I get and a responsibility that I have in my job.
When did you become aware that you needed to take care of yourself? This is not a place where most of us start. This is a place some of us don't come to until way late in life.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think, so it's funny because we actually, when I was a kid, my mom would put us in for what she called belaxers. I'm not totally sure where that came from, but it was like relaxation time. It wasn't a nap. You just had to be quiet. It often coincided with when she was watching General Hospital. But
it's a multifunction, right, multi-purpose, it was a, multitasking.
Right. She was multitasking. But it was a time when we had to be by ourselves and we had to be quiet. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes I would play by myself. I would read books. Sometimes I would sleep. But it's funny to think now. I mean, I was like 5, 6, seven. I mean, it went on till maybe I was 10 or something. But it was like this intentional time in the day where I took care of myself. You know, I didn't think of it that way.
Right. Yeah,
but
yeah.
It was just me time.
Right.
And I don't still take an hour in the afternoon between 3 and 4 to do that. Although
except
that sounds
Sundays.
Lovely now, like, right. Except on Sundays. But I think, that has stayed with me that there's, I don't know. I'm trying to think maybe when I was in college, I guess which was really when I was sort of like not at home and didn't have, you know, the family structure to sort of, do that, there would be times when people would be going out or they'd be going to even to the dining hall to eat together. And I would be like, I think I need to stay back and do my own thing. Mm-hmm. Or I would, you know, I felt like I needed to go to the dining hall and talk with tons of people. So I'd like, you know, go rally all the people from their rooms and get them to go. So yeah, I guess it's been sort of over the course of my life, realizing that that's something that I need to do. But I think as someone who cares a lot for other people as part of my ministry, that has really become a really important factor to me, that if I'm not taking care of myself, I can't take care of other people, right? And we know that, but...
But it's like you said, I mean, there was a time when I used to ask people, kind of, you're a planner. Mm-hmm. You need to have these things scheduled in your day. And what I found in the first 200 guests, and I'm 400 plus in, was that about 30 to 40% were planners and about, you know, 60 to 70% were people who just needed to sense it and then they would go with it. The people who sensed it and went with it tended to learn it a little later in life, or that was my sense of them as people.
Mm-hmm.
Those who had tended to be a little bit more like yourself.
Yeah.
So, and I think there's no right way or wrong way. It's just kind of how it works.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I think that I am sort of naturally someone who just goes. Mm-hmm. Like, and in all honesty, my wife is someone who oftentimes will be the one to say, so I'm feeling like you need to sort of stop right now and take some time for yourself. Like, she's also this sort of reminder for me of, she can read me really well.
Right.
And
right.
She can know if I need, you know, to take a day and just focus on myself.
How does she do you make observations of her, and how does she respond to your observations of her? You describe it as an act of grace towards yourself.
Yeah.
How does she receive it when you make them in her direction?
I guess I do it too. She's personality wise, she's a lot different than me. So she is also someone who gets a lot done and is fairly driven, but I think she's a lot better at just naturally at reading herself.
Right.
So I don't necessarily have to.
Right. My partner didn't assume that she could do that and would be well received, but it is, I do receive it well. It's taken us years to kind of figure it out. We've been together about 5 years. So but that's, you know, it takes time to sort these things.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, she's realized that really the best way for me to take a break is for her to take me far away.
Vacation is a wonderful concept.
Like, staycation is not a thing that can happen in our house.
Margaret, it has been wonderful to get to know you.
It's been great to be with you.
What should we play? What should we close the show with?
Let's see. Let's do Holy Now.
When I was a boy each week, on Sunday we would go to church and pay attention to the priest. He would read the holy word and consecrate the holy bread, and everyone would kneel and bow. Today the only difference is everything is holy now. Everything is holy now. And when I was in Sunday school, we would learn about the time Moses split the sea in two, and Jesus made the water wine. And I remember feeling sad. Miracles don't happen still. Now I can't keep track, 'cause everything's a miracle. Everything's a miracle. Wine from water is not so small, but an even better magic trick. Hear it all. So the challenging thing becomes not to look for miracles, but finding where there isn't one. When holy water was rare at best, it barely wet my fingertips, but now I have to hold my breath. Swimming in a sea of it. It used to be a world half there, heaven's second rate hand me down, but I walk it with a reverent air, 'cause everything is holy now. A burning bush,
and singing like a scripture verse. It made me want to bow my head. I remember when church let out, how things have changed since then. Everything is holy now. It used to be a world half there, heaven's second rate hand me down. But I walk it with a reverent air, 'cause everything is holy.